Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
Take it back. And yesterday is about wrongness, about being wrong. And, well, let me just set the stage here a little bit for you, okay? So being wrong actually has a lot of subsets to it. I mean, for example, there are just errors of fact, right? You say something and you don't get it right. I often enjoy the New York Times corrections because they go into quite a bit of detail about what they've gotten wrong. As you'll hear a little bit later in the show, the New York Times isn't always great about this stuff, but their corrections can be very entertaining. So here's a correction from a recent day. An obituary on Wednesday about the singer and songwriter Eric Carmen referred incorrectly at one point to the song All By Myself. As noted elsewhere in the obituary, it was released in 1975. It is not a 1980s anthem. Because of an editing error, the obituary also misstated who wrote the song Hungry Eyes, which was a hit for Mr. Carmen in 1987. It was written by John DiNicola and Frankie Previte, not by Mr. Carmen. And the obituary misstated the name of the debut album by Mr. Carmen's band, The Raspberries. It was Raspberries, not The Raspberries. So I think we got all that nailed down. But those are just errors of fact. They can be corrected. Then there are times when people are just more pervasively wrong about something. They really have failed to understand or grasp a situation. And when I say those words, what pops into my mind is the entire journalistic establishment, the entire American political journalistic establishment in 2016. We're going to hear a little clip. This is actually from July of 2015. This is from ABC This Week. The first voice you'll hear is Keith Ellison, who I think was a congressman at the time, later became Minnesota's attorney general. Then you'll hear George Stephanopoulos. And it's important to know that the woman's voice you'll hear a woman laughing, and then you'll hear a woman's voice. That is the voice of Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, who eventually became the so-called Trump whisperer. But here we go. A1, Mr. Reyes.
All I want to say is that anybody from the Democratic side of the fence who's terrified of the possibility of President Trump, better vote, better get active, better get involved, because this man has got some momentum, and we better be ready for the fact that he might be leading the Republican ticket.
Next, I know you don't believe that, but I want to go on.
Sorry to laugh.
All right. Yeah, the person saying sorry to laugh after laughing really hard at the idea of Donald Trump being any kind of front runner or the head of the Republican ticket. That's Maggie Haberman, who's like now made a career out of covering President and ex-President Trump. And it wasn't just journalists who were fooled in this way. A very, very smart politician, maybe in some ways the most comprehensively smart politician I've ever seen, made a similar mistake. This is in February of 2016. Let's play A2.
I'll leave it to you to speculate on how this whole race is going to go. I continue to believe Mr. Trump will not be president. And the reason is because I have a lot of faith in the American people. And I think they recognize that being president is a serious job.
So it's actually fair to ask whether President Obama is wrong about Donald Trump becoming president, or whether he's wrong to have faith in the American people to make that not happen. In any case, I do want to say, I want to implicate myself a little bit too. In 2016, I was writing about this in my newspaper column. I was talking about this on the air. And additionally, I was teaching a class then at Trinity College. It was a graduate liberal studies class that was mainly, it had people in it, like teachers who were getting their master's degrees and stuff like that. But it was about political journalism and modern political media. And we were kind of teaching the election in real time, or teaching the coverage of the election in real time. And on election night 2016, I thought it would be fun for my students to come in here to the newsroom here in public radio land and just watch us cover it. And we'd have a little party there, because after all, the outcome was a foregone conclusion. So, you know, we could relax, right? And at a certain point in the evening, I gathered all those students together and I said, what you should do tomorrow is go to the bursar's office and see if they can prorate your tuition and get your money back for this class, because I clearly don't know what I'm talking about. I've been telling you for months now that Hillary Clinton is a prohibitive favorite here, and that is obviously not the case. She's about to lose. Trump is about to win. And you know, I'm so glad I said that then, and I've said it many times since then, because when you admit you're wrong, when you admit you were just galactically wrong about something, it actually makes you feel a little stronger rather than a little bit weaker. I think we feel it's an act of weakness to admit that we're wrong. But the person who can speak to this far more learnedly and eloquently than I can or have is our next guest, our first guest, Aranda Jayawikrama, a professor of psychology at Wake Forest University and a specialist in something called intellectual humility, something very few people seem to have. It's amazing that there's even a field that could have this name. But first of all, welcome to our show. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
So maybe just give us a thumbnail description. What is meant by intellectual? I mean, in some ways, it is a self-explanatory term, but maybe it's not. Help us understand it.
Well, you know, as you said, to some extent, being intellectually humble, you know, the definition's there in the phrase. It means being open to the possibility that you could be wrong about your beliefs or wrong about the knowledge that you currently have. As you know, in the research, we tend to think about intellectual humility as having two components to it. One is what we call a metacognitive component, which means pretty much thinking about your thinking, right? So the idea is that you're able to reflect on your thoughts and acknowledge that, okay, maybe I could be wrong about what I believe. I'm open to the possibility of being wrong. And I should note that there's some researchers who think that is the core component of intellectual humility. But there's also another component that's important, at least in my mind, which is the interpersonal component, right? So the idea that not only could I be wrong about my beliefs, but also other people might have important information or important knowledge that could be helpful to me as I try to increase the accuracy of my beliefs. Now, it's worth keeping in mind that if you look at philosophical discussions of wisdom, for example, I know, you know, you had a really interesting episode of your show last year on wisdom, but, you know, many philosophers say that intellectual humility is a key component of wisdom, because being intellectually humble involves an epistemic decentering of your own beliefs, right? You can't assume that you know everything about the world. So, you know, being intellectually humble is important, not only because, you know, we all aspire to be wise, but without being intellectually humble, you can't learn anything about the world, right? You can't update your beliefs. So in my mind, it's a very important trait for increasing our understanding of what's true about the world.
This movement is, I think, something that's kind of grown over the last 10 years. Over the last 10 years or so, we've also seen a kind of generalized epistemic crisis in America, where arriving at agreements about what is true, what is right, and what is wrong has become especially thorny. There's a tendency now to discredit the source of information that suggests that you are wrong and to substitute for it a different source of information that suggests that one is right. And increasingly, we even see experts. I mean, for example, even now, over the last 3 or 4 days on social media, I've borne witness to a number of very prestigious experts in epidemiology, virology, research into pandemic outbreaks, still having a fight about the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Was it a lab leak? Did it happen in a wet market? This is still going on, and people are not being nice to one another. And I'm wondering whether the intellectual humility movement is in any way kind of a response to a moment in American public life where it seems we're especially bad at arriving at even some kind of agreement about how we're going to verify things.
No, I think that makes sense. You know, I've only lived in the United States for around 22 years, but my memory of being here around the time of, you know, the presidency of George W. Bush and, you know, and then, you know, the years following that is that it seems like political polarization was one motivation for increased interest in intellectual humility. And I think one reason why, I think intellectual humility is very important, but it can be hard for us to manifest, right? Because, you know, to some extent, we all care about the truth. We care about being accurate about what we know about ourselves and about the world, but we also crave meaning, right? We want to be able to understand this world. And, you know, the philosopher Karl Popper spoke about how, you know, we can only know so much. And the one thing that we can be sure about is that there's a lot that we don't know about. And, you know, scientists who are supposed to be, you know, in the, you know, pursuing knowledge and, you know, pursuing the truth about the world. We fall prey to this as well. You know, you might have heard about the replication crisis, where a lot of very prominent findings in psychology, in other fields, turned out to be, you know, not replicable when people ran follow-up studies. And one reason why is that, you know, we are scientists, we are also human. So we care about getting it right. We also care about prestige. We care about getting on the media. We care about status. So being intellectually humble, it's important, but also it's hard because it involves some degree of existential uncertainty, right? You have to be open to the fact that important beliefs that are at the core of your identity may not be true, right? So I think, you know, it's worth keeping in mind that, you know, intellectual humility is clearly important, but it takes work to manifest. And none of us, even those of us who are supposed to be making a career about seeking the truth, you know, find it particularly easy.
Right. I mean, none of this takes place in any kind of social or professional background, vacuum, excuse me, so that, you know, most people in academia, you know, they might be pursuing tenure or something else and going to your department chairman and saying, guess how many things I got wrong this year? Although it might be an act of intellectual humility, it also might be an act of career suicide, right? You have to create an environment where people feel reasonably safe adopting a position of intellectual humility.
I think that's exactly right. And that's why I feel like, you know, if we want to promote intellectual humility, we need to change the structures in which we engage, right? Either in our work life or in public life. Because, you know, it's very easy for me to say that, oh, you know, you just have to try to be more intellectually humble. And maybe, you know, if you have a person of certain status or a person of certain power, that can be important. But as you said, right, if you are someone pursuing tenure, and you decide to be intellectually humble and talk about all the work you did and how they didn't work in interesting ways. Now, there is a movement now to maybe promote that type of transparency in research. But until more people accept the fact that this is how we should be doing research, this is how we should be doing science, right? You know, you can imagine that person having challenges when they do go up for tenure and promotion.
Right. And I mean, I think the other problem is that the public tends not to understand as well how some of these processes work. And we saw that up close in 2020 when the scientific community was trying to understand COVID, trying to understand the behavior of this novel coronavirus. And the way that science typically does this is to try to work towards some kind of conclusion. If those conclusions turn out to be wrong based on further study, further testing, revising, that's kind of how science makes its progress. But this time it was doing that fully in the public eye so that, you know, from moment to moment, Tony Fauci, acting on the best information that he might have had, would have repeatedly had to correct himself about asymptomatic spread, aerosol transmission, the utility of masks. And the doubters and deniers seized on that as a way of saying, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know anything. This might not even be what they say it is. Because I think the general public's undereducated about how science reaches conclusions through testing and revision.
I think that's exactly right. And you know, one, you know, I teach a research methods class, and you know, one thing I try to emphasize is that, you know, we don't prove things, right? We don't do research to say that something is true or not. What we do is we make, you know, predictions about, you know, something being true or not in a given study, or something being supported or not in a given study. And then we say that this is contingent, right? This is just based on the methods we have and what we know about a particular phenomenon. But you always have to do follow-up research. You always have to, you know, be open to critiquing your own work, which is challenging, right? You know, but I think another issue that comes up is, and I think this is true for even experts, people struggle with this idea of probabilities, right? That something can be true when you run one set of studies, but you can't just focus on that set of studies. You need to do multiple studies, see whether you have the same pattern show up over and over again. So I have an example related to the 2016 election, because I was teaching research methods in the fall of 2016. And one thing we did when we were talking about probability is that we looked at, Nate Silver used to run 538, right? And the last class I had before the election, he gave Trump like 29 to 30%.
Right.
And I will say at that point, I thought, oh, Trump's probably going to lose. So, but because I was in class, what I said was, look, the prediction is that Trump has a 30% chance of winning. What do we think about that? Most students said, oh, that means he's not going to win. And I said, well, how about I told you that you had a 29 or 30% chance of getting into your first choice graduate school? Would you take it? And all of them said, yes, because, you know, they knew the probability of getting into that top choice school was way lower than 30%. So my point was like, look, he actually has a 1 in 3 chance of winning. So that means he could win. So I didn't expect him to win, but it was interesting. The class after the election, I started class by saying, well, you know, I didn't expect that to happen, but given what we discussed, you shouldn't have been surprised. But, you know, the students were very upset. It was interesting. You know, there were students who were liberal who were very upset about what happened. There were students who were conservative who were upset because they felt victimized by the students who were liberal. But I think one reason why students were upset is that even though they saw the probabilities, right, there's something about, you know, the fact that it was such a politicized election and people had such strong views about, you know, voting for Trump or voting for Clinton, right, depending on your political persuasion, that they couldn't track the fact that, oh, you know, there's a possibility that my strong belief about the election going a particular way could be wrong.
Right. I mean, if, Silver made that point afterwards, because, and once again, nothing happens in a vacuum. So Silver had gotten famous for being incredibly accurate with his predictions. He had predicted essentially every electoral vote correctly, I think in 08 and maybe close to or better than that in 2012. You know, he kind of make mistakes. So there was this kind of idea that if he said something, it was a reliable basis for action. But as you suggest, you know, if you were boarding an airplane and the pilot came on the PA system and said, you know, 30% of the time these planes crash, I just want you to know that, you'd get off the plane. That's not an acceptable level of risk. So a lot of it is context too. But I mean, I think there were people who said, oh no, Nate got it wrong.
And
you can't entirely blame them, because this whole thing was set up with the idea that Nate Silver had this grasp that other people didn't have.
No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, so I know many people who said, oh, you know, even Nate Silver got it wrong in 2016. And, you know, I would have conversations with them saying, well, no, he was, you know, given a probability. And yes, Clinton was the favorite, but it wasn't, you know, 95-5, you know, that I think was his prediction for Obama-Romney, right? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's 70-30, which means there's a good chance that the 30% could come to pass. So again, you know, this, I think, speaks to the point that, you know, even though in principle, many of us would agree that it's important for us to be open to the possibility that we are wrong. That can be very hard to do when it comes to issues or topics that really get at, you know, core values that we think are central to our identity.
Yeah, and I think also how you handle the aftermath is important. And I think, you know, Nate Silver, for example, just to stay with him for a second, got kind of defensive afterwards. And I was watching him and thinking, well, if you're going to set it up this way, you'll never be wrong. As long as you leave a 1% chance of the other thing happening, you can always say I wasn't wrong. But it probably would have been better, and this sort of gets back to your specialty, to have said something a little bit more humble, you know, something a little bit more, you know, I'm not happy with my own performance here, or something along those lines. But what are your thoughts about that?
No, I think so. It's interesting, right? On the one hand, I think you're correct that maybe Silver could have been more upfront about, like, this is what these probabilities mean. Now, it's quite possible that, you know, it's been a long time since I've looked at the articles that came out in 2016. Maybe he did that at least in, you know, on his website. Now, what he said publicly, you know, maybe could have been different. But this, I think this speaks to one of the challenges about being intellectually humble in our current society, right? Which is that, you know, when people are, you know, engaging with the media, or, you know, when people are looking for information, they want certainty, right? You know, part of the problem with these probabilistic forecasts is that many people just want to know, is this person going to win or lose? Right? Is this outcome going to work out or not? which unfortunately isn't the type of prediction, right, someone like Silver or someone in my field can make, right? We can just make a probabilistic judgment. So I wonder whether, you know, part of the problem is that, you know, maybe the media is setting things up in this sort of way, you know, simple way. It also could be that many people only understand, right, these types of predictions in an all or nothing way, right? So I think it just might be one of those, you know, one of these challenges, right, that all of us, right, we want to know the truth, but we also crave certainty. In some cases, but in most cases, right, there is no certainty about the truth. At least that's one lesson that comes from science.
Right. So in research, as I understand it, you know, other researchers will say, will rank intellectual humility very high as an attribute even pointing towards wisdom, whereas the average person is maybe a little less impressed and is more inclined to say, well, why am I listening to you if you're not really going to guarantee to me that you're correct? Could you say a little bit more about that, about how the average person processes this idea of intellectual humility?
So, you know, one of our ongoing projects is looking at, you know, the different types of intellectual traits that you need to have to be a good thinker, right? So, you know, it's important to be intellectually humble, but you also need to be motivated to seek out the truth. You need to focus on the right type of information. You need to be open-minded when you're engaging with people you disagree with, you know, so on and so forth. So, you know, we just completed this large study where we surveyed experts in different fields. We also surveyed a representative sample of Americans. And what we found was, you know, among the experts, especially among philosophers and psychologists, intellectual humility is seen as important, right? And perhaps the most important trait. And as I mentioned earlier, that makes sense because you can't learn unless you acknowledge that your pre-existing or your past beliefs are wrong, right? So it would make sense that it comes out number one. It came out really low among in the American sample, the non-expert sample. And instead, you know, more proactive traits like, you know, being critical-minded or being, having high levels of intellectual perseverance or being, you know, committed to figuring things out no matter what, intellectual tenacity. Those traits were focused on much more by the lay public. So, you know, if you think about it, it sort of makes sense, right? Like people don't want to think about the fact they could be wrong when they think about the characteristics of a good thinker. They don't think about themselves, I'm going to seek out the information, right? I'm going to be brave. I'm going to be bold. And, you know, to some extent, this makes sense. But I also think this, again, speaks to the challenge of promoting a characteristic like intellectual humility, right? Like clearly, you can't learn about the world. You can't engage in personal growth. You can't cultivate better quality relationships without it. But when we think about what it means to be a good thinker, for most people, that's not the first trait that comes to mind.
Right. And, you know, as bad as we are about this in the U.S., I have a worse example. And it's from Italy. In 2009, there was a terrible earthquake in Italy. And after that, six seismologists were accused of misleading the public because they didn't portray the risk as acutely, I guess, as some people thought they should. They were actually sentenced to prison for manslaughter. An appeals court eventually overturned their 6 years prison sentence. But, you know, seismologists around the world were saying, you know, we don't want to have to be worried about the idea that we're going to go to jail if we give advice about earthquakes. That would really discourage giving honest opinions. And that, this is probably going to have to be our last subject area. Mm-hmm. That's a big problem, right? You don't want to create such heavy sanctions against people who admit to getting something wrong or obviously get something wrong so that they're, people become uncomfortable giving their opinions.
Oh, no, that sounds like a terrible story. And you're absolutely right. I think, you know, we should have the opportunity and the freedom to say what we think is true, right, based on our research, based on our findings, and also convey uncertainty about our findings, right? Like the fact that, you know, this is what we know, but also we're using this set of evidence, right? This is what we know so far that might change. And, you know, going back to the example you raised about COVID, right, the fact that because COVID was such a moving target, right, and there were things that we thought was true about COVID, such as the fact that you had to have symptoms in order to spread the virus, and it turned out later on that actually asymptomatic spread is the way that most people caught COVID, right? That was stuff we had to figure out on the go, right? And as you said, like part of the reason why, at least in the US, it got so politicized, right? You know, it didn't get politicized in the UK or in Canada, but that's, I guess, a different topic. But the fact that it got politicized in the US was I think, one reason why people started holding, you know, what Fauci and others were saying to this sort of, you know, unreasonable standard, given how little we knew about the virus at the beginning of 2020.
Right. We were trying to build a bridge and walk across it at the same time. We have to pause there, but Iranda Jayawikrama is a professor of psychology at Wake Forest University and an expert in intellectual humility. All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to talk to somebody on the other side who changed his mind in a very important way. You got to learn how to fall before you learn to fly. Mama, mama. It ain't no lie. Before you learn to fly, learn how to fall.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed. And in our center, with a special ECMO on the Go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Oh, Polly, oh, Polly, it's for your sake alone. I've left my old father, my country, my home. I've left my old mother to weep and to mourn. I am a rebel soldier. And far.
So getting ready for this segment today, I was looking at all kinds of different things, and I came across a clip from 1957 of President Eisenhower, who, of course, was a five-star general. And he was talking about the fact that in his office, in the Oval Office, he had pictures of the four greatest Americans, in his opinion. One of them was Franklin, another was Washington, another was Lincoln, and the third was Robert E. Lee. And in the clip that I saw from 1957, he was telling the press that it wasn't really worth anybody's time, suggesting to him that he change his relationship with Robert E. Lee. He wasn't going to do it. A similar dilemma faced our guest now. We're going to talk to Ty Sigili, who is a visiting professor of history at Hamilton College and the author of Robert E. Lee and Me. He's a retired brigadier general in the U.S. Army and the former vice chair of the Department of Defense's Naming Commission. So first of all, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And you were of the same mind as Ike for a long time, that Robert E. Lee was a person worthy of valorization and maybe unworthy of severe criticism. Talk a little bit about that, how you started out, and then we can talk about where you got to.
Yeah, I grew up believing that Lee was sort of almost a god among men. I mean, on the Spinal Tap scale, if you've seen that movie,
yes.
I would have rated Lee an 11 on a scale of 10. And even though I was a good Episcopalian, went to church every Sunday, I put Jesus as probably about a 6. So it wasn't just that he was a good, it was that it was a reverential. And that was my whole culture, thought of him as reverential. And I was bused across town to the from the white elementary school named after Douglas MacArthur to the segregated all-black school named Robert E. Lee Elementary. I went to Washington and Lee University because I wanted to be a Virginia gentleman, which was the symbol of status and power in my community. And so, yeah, every part of me believed that. The only problem was it was a lie.
Right. But let me just stop at the moment of before we get to it being a lie. I think it's understandable and forgivable, particularly for people in the military. You know, as I say, Ike was a 5-star general. General Stanley McChrystal went through the same evolution that you went through. Yeah, I think he's also from Virginia, and that may be play a role too. But, you know, if you're a general, if you're a high-ranking officer in the military, you understand the kinds of decisions that you have to make in wartime. You understand the way that Lee carried himself, his general deportment as a soldier. If you're only looking at that, free of context, it's, I think, not that surprising he'd be an 11. But tell me what you think.
Well, yes, except, you know, he lost. So, I mean, we made I was born on July 3rd, which is the day that he led the battle at Gettysburg, where he ordered 13,000 soldiers to attack on Pickett's Charge, which was an unmitigated disaster. So he had great victories in 1862 and early 1863. But after that, it was one loss after another. And he lost as decisively as any enemy we have ever fought ever. And he killed U.S. Army soldiers. So while, yes, it was, I can understand why I did, because, you know, does a fish know it's wet? No, every part of my culture as a white Southerner made me believe that Lee was the greatest of all humans. But this was done for a pernicious purpose, when in reality, there were far better generals like Ulysses S. Grant. So, yeah, it was the fact that my culture deemed him to be that great. It had a reason for doing that. But in reality, no, he really wasn't that great. And I think that's part of what the reason why we have to think about why it was that my culture, that the White South made him into this godlike figure.
I mean, as I understand it, one of the turning points for you was joining the military, was encountering a more diverse workforce, so to speak, than you had typically experienced before, and suddenly understanding that there were other perspectives, other voices, and other forms of stakeholding in a debate like this one.
I think that it absolutely changed me. And so my identity, and I think, you know, history forms our identity. My identity was to be a white Southern gentleman. Then it became an Army officer. And then, you know, then it became a scholar, a historian. And, you know, I married somebody who was incapable of lying, and my culture was based on lies. So all those three things really changed me to be able to look at my past and the past of our country more honestly. But, you know, it's hard to do that when you grow up with a certain set of values, and history becomes our values in a way. If you look at the Army bases that were all named after Confederates and all the statues that permeated the areas I grew up in, all of these were meant to show that the Confederates were worthy of commemoration, worthy of glory, worthy of honor. And so, yeah, it's not surprising I grew up that way, but it doesn't make it accurate.
So you didn't just change your mind about this. You changed your mind very publicly. You gave a speech. You eventually wrote a book. You didn't have to do that, right? You could have just told your wife and a few other people and left it at that. If it came up at a dinner party, maybe you'd talk about it. So why go as public as you did? Because obviously there were going to be consequences when you did that.
Well, there were consequences even before I did. So I did a video for PragerU, very conservative, in 2015, where I said the Civil War is about slavery. And it's had like 35 million views since then. I got death threats to my West Point email address. I was a professor there for many years. The Army threatened to investigate me for political speech. I became a public person there, which I didn't really understand I was going to be. And then that led me to realize, oh my gosh, history is dangerous because it challenges our myths or identities. And then I've been researching and talking about this for 10, 15 years. But at one time when I was at West Point and chair of the commemoration, the memorialization committee, and we were deciding, this was after Iraq and Afghanistan, or during those wars, when West Point lost 100 graduates killed in action in those wars, and we hadn't really had a place to memorialize them. So I came up with the idea to memorialize them in one room. But the question was, should Confederate graduates, so we were going to memorialize all West Point graduates who, in Lincoln's words, gave the last full measure of devotion to the nation. But should Confederate graduates go in there? And I argued, no, they shouldn't. They killed U.S. Army soldiers. They killed, they abrogated their oath. They fought to destroy their country for the worst possible reason, to create a slave republic. But I got nowhere. In fact, our leadership at the time They later rescinded this decision, but first said, no, we want to bring people together. And I went back to my wife and I said, you know, I couldn't get them to believe this. And so this historical facts. And so she said, well, Ty, did you tell them about your own background? I said, no, I'm a historian. I tell other people's stories, not my own. And she rightly said that if you're ever going to convince somebody, you've got to tell your own story. And it turns out that facts don't change people's minds, but stories do. Mm. And so the only way I could really convince people was to tell my own story.
Having changed your mind about something that was fairly important to you, did it make you a little bit more elastic in general about maybe reconsidering your own opinions or admitting that you're wrong about something? It's something a lot of people find very difficult to do. And you admitted you were wrong or decided you were wrong in a public context about a very, very highly charged question. I'm just wondering, you know, just day to day or in your research, your work as a scholar, whatever, did it make you a little bit better? Did it build up the maybe I was wrong muscle?
It totally did. I mean, I use this one line, sort of taking it from an old Army commercial, which is I'm wrong more often before 9 o'clock than most people are all day. And I said, oh, yeah, I'm wrong all the time. I know I'm wrong all the time. It doesn't bother me to be wrong. And you know, it's sort of a powerful thing to be able to do, to publicly admit you're wrong and change your mind. So yeah, I'm wrong all the time. Doesn't bother me to be wrong. And I mean, I'm not wrong about this one subject of which I've done so much research and written so much. I mean, I really do believe that Robert E. Lee chose treason to preserve slavery, and that the Confederates aren't worthy of commemoration of a great nation like us. But on other many other things, I haven't done that research on. Yeah, I'll change on a dime, give you 7 cents change.
Yeah, I'm thinking of JFK, who after the Bay of Pigs said, I'm going to just paraphrase it, but he said something to the effect that success has many fathers, failure is an orphan, and that, you know, we really don't want to be the person saying I was wrong. But what's weird about it, I'll also quote Twain, who said something to the effect that the problem with lying is you have to keep track of a lot of details. I think the problem with insisting that you're right about things all the time is that you have to put a lot of energy into it. I mean, the probability that anybody's right all the time is close to zero. So that means you're working really hard to convince yourself and others that you're right about everything. It just seems like a huge expenditure of energy for almost no benefit.
Yeah, and like, who hasn't been in a relationship? Like, that's part of the deal with being in a relationship, is admitting that you're wrong. I mean, it just goes with the territory of being a human being. So I think the better we are at doing that, the more human we are.
I think we're going to end on that note, but Ty Sigili, thank you so much. Visiting professor of history at Hamilton College and the author of Robert E. Lee and Me. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk to a journalist who has a very proactive approach to corrections.
All episodes of The Colin McEnroe Show are available 24/7 on any podcast app. If there's a place for reviews and ratings, give us lots of stars and be sure to mention the high thread count in our sheets and pillowcases, as well as the complimentary breakfast buffet. Have a question or comment? Email us at colinshow@ctpublic.org. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Sabrina, and thanks also to the maestro, Dylan Reyes. He is our technical producer today. And McCusker the Wonder Kid and her bad cat Penelope are the producers of this show. I am not wrong about Penelope, by the way. Penelope is a bad cat. All right, our final guest here is somebody who I feel like I know Isaac Saul at this point, although we've never met, but I've talked to him on the show before. But maybe more importantly, I teach his work in a journalism seminar that I teach at Yale. And I'm not exaggerating when I say my students invariably are more excited about what Isaac does with Tangle, his newsletter, than they are about anything else I teach them, including me. So it's good to have Isaac on. And first of all, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Always glad to come on.
So one of the things I do on the first session of that class most years is I ask the students who they trust and why they trust certain news media. And one of the things that does come up, I bring it up if nobody else does, is you should be more likely to trust somebody that runs corrections. That, you know, I mean, I think in the back of our minds, particularly as journalists, it's like, oh, if I run a lot of corrections, people are going to decide I'm no good. Whereas in a lot of ways, the opposite should be true. That should engender trust. But I feel like as journalists, we kind of, not you, but a lot of us have this reluctance to admit we're wrong.
I certainly, you know, for a large part of my career, I would say, was so scared of the correction. I mean, it was kind of the scarlet letter to have a piece that was living online somewhere or living in print with a correction appended to it. I mean, that was sort of like the worst nightmare for a lot of journalists, which I think created a dynamic, at least I know in my experience, where I would want to fight a correction. I mean, even in instances where maybe in the back of my head, I felt like or understood that I was wrong or had made an error, it was just that you didn't want that attached to your work. And it felt like something that sort of undermined the credibility of your work in a way that would be tough to shake down the line.
Right. I got in trouble a few years ago. I wrote a column for Hearst and I outraged James O'Keefe, I think is his name, the guy from Project Veritas. And these two Hearst lawyers called me up because they'd gotten some kind of hello letter. And after we talked for a while, there was like one thing that had come up. And I said, you know, I'm not one of these people who says you can't run a correction about my work. Just go ahead. If that's going to help this go away, run the correction. And I could hear them sigh with relief because I think an awful lot of people just don't want to have that happen. But you go the extra mile with this because, yeah, the New York Times has this weird little corrections mini section most days where you can find corrections. And other journalistic entities append the correction maybe to the bottom of the story. You put it right at the top. Explain why you do that.
Yeah, so there are a couple of reasons. First of all, I am trying to do something different. I mean, I built this newsletter and this media company, Tangle, where we are sort of starting with a blank page and don't necessarily have to follow some of the traditional norms that I grew up on in the journalism space. And one of the things that just occurred to me was the footnote correction, or even worse, the kind of ghost edit that happens right after publication when something is called out, it does impact the view that people have of certain media outlets. And it does create a dynamic where I think they are trusted less, especially when those corrections are kind of obscured or hidden or they're not prominent. And so we had this idea early on to not just publish corrections prominently, but to track them and to explain them, you know, to actually say how the mistake happened, which is something I don't see any news outlets really doing right now. I mean, occasionally at a place like the New York Times, you'll get a sort of post-mortem on an article that comes from the staff. Well, they'll write, you know, an explanation of how they flubbed a story, which I think is actually great. Unfortunately, it usually comes, you know, weeks or even months later. And a lot of the people who saw the original story don't see it. So we literally send out a newsletter every day, and we will put at the top of the newsletter a correction. We'll tell you, you know, what number correction it is and how many days we've been doing this. So we track the count and we'll explain how it happens. And the first time I did it, the feedback was just so tremendously positive that it occurred to me immediately that this was something that was both unique and was also building a sort of trust and relationship with the readership that wouldn't have existed otherwise.
You know, you mentioned the Times, and they're kind of all over the map with this stuff. I should have researched this before, so I'm going to do it from memory, and I may get it wrong, in which case I'll have to run a correction. But I recall that they did kind of a massive story-length correction about their coverage about the causes of entry into the Iraq War, that whole sort of 2003 moment later. I think it was probably connected to the Judith Miller stuff. But it was like the most massive mea culpa I think I've ever seen a newspaper do. But as you say, And one of their public editors, a guy named Arthur Brisbane, was the one person who really noticed this. In the digital age, you could do what you call it ghost editing. It's, you know, the New York Times might say, well, we're just revising. We're revising the thing that's online, right, as new information becomes available. But say a little bit more about that, because it does seem insidious in terms of establishing, sticking a pin in a permanent record. This is what the Times, which used to be called the paper of record, said about such and such a thing.
Well, first of all, you can't get away with it anymore. There are too many eyes on these publications. There are too many tools like the Wayback Machine, where you can, you know, look at what a web page looked like 5 minutes ago versus what it looks like now. And there's just so many people who are involved in kind of the information gathering and dissemination process around media, you know, for better or for worse, that you're not going to get away with it without getting caught. And yet, we see places like the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal publish something and then go into the article and change maybe a language choice or cut a sentence or update the headline. One of the most recent examples of this was something that I actually wrote about, which was the hospital bombing that happened in Gaza. And the New York Times was one of the first papers. It was the first paper, major paper, to report it. And their initial headline said something like, you know, 500 people killed in Israeli strike in Gaza. And it was a, you know, picture of the hospital, whatever, and this explosion that had happened. And then 20 minutes later, they kind of updated the piece to say, like, the Palestinians said this. And then they updated the piece to say the Gaza Health Ministry said this. And then they removed Israel from, you know, being the subject, the people who had done the strike, and just said explosion at Gaza hospital kills 500 people, Palestinians say. And these changes happened in a matter of an hour. And then, you know, we know now, basically from the New York Times' own reporting, that over the next few days, the prominent theory came to be that it was actually, you know, an Islamic jihadist group inside Gaza that had misfired a rocket that landed on this hospital. And they ended up issuing this whole public editor note explaining how they had been too reliant on the Gaza Health Ministry for their initial on-the-ground reporting. But all those changes in the headline happened at the Times without any sort of, you know, notice or issue or correction, or, you know, they changed the language in the first few paragraphs to sort of shift the blame away from Israel. And obviously this was a huge story, you know, millions of people were reading it. So everybody saw it, and the kind of internet sleuth media watchdog people were screen capping the headlines and the way the lead was changing and sharing how they were updating it in real time with no actual explanation. And that destroyed a lot of people's trust in the New York Times, because it showed that they had not actually done the proper legwork before publishing this story, which I assume was just a product of them trying to be the first ones to report it. And that makes them look, you know, to a lot of people, what was interesting about that was, to a lot of kind of the pro-Israel side, it was like this example of the New York Times being biased against Israel. And then to a lot of people who are kind of more in the pro-Palestinian political mindset, it was this example of Israel and sort of the Zionist influence on the media, you know, kind of pushing the New York Times away from its initial reporting. And many people still believe to this day that Israel was responsible for that strike, even though a lot of the evidence suggests that they weren't. So it just is a huge mess, and it's made by them not being transparent and forthright about what they're doing.
Yeah, it's interesting too. We should say something about Tangle, which is that what Isaac does in Tangle, typically with his big story of the day, he tells you what the right is saying about it, and then what the left is saying about it, and then you say what you're thinking about it. And it was interesting because David Lenhardt, about a month after this whole thing in the New York Times, did a kind of Isaac Saul-like thing where he walked through four different explanations of this and then sort of talked about which one he would lean towards. And so your influence may be even greater than you realize. I do want to say, just before we run out of time, that Tangle, which really is a great newsletter, people should be getting it, but you've run in your five-year history 100 corrections, which is not very much. I mean, 1,500 articles, something like that. You didn't actually mislead us about the threat posed by Iraq or anything of that size.
Right.
But you did your 100th correction, and you kind of made a little bit of a thing about it, right?
Yeah, we had some fun with it. The 100th correction was quite silly. We were had identified Walter Nauta, or Walt Nauta, a Trump aide who was, you know, involved in some of the mishandling, the alleged mishandling of the classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. And I saw that his name was Walt Nauta. That's how a lot of papers were kind of reporting on him. And so I think, like any normal person would, I assumed his real name was Walter Nauta, and that maybe some places were using this as shorthand. So in our initial identification of him, we called him Walter Nauta in our story. And then some eagle-eyed reader wrote in and said, hey, like, funny, weird thing, that guy's name is actually Waltine, which was a name that I had never heard before.
I think his mother may have named him after a cracker or something. We're out of time, Isaac, but this has been a great conversation. Isaac Saul is the founder of the newsletter Tangle, which you should be getting in your inbox. Thanks for listening today. They got their armies and the chosen ones, but we'll all be burning in the same big sun when the great correction comes.